We have time for some questions, and it's the research delegation of Erandi Vergara Vargas who is responsible for the first question.
Hi, good morning. My name is Mark Lippo. I'm a postdoc researcher at McGill. Thank you both very much. Fascinating, fascinating talks. I wanted to pick up a theme on, it came up in both presentations, and I think it's been part of the conversation both yesterday and will be today. Graham, you called it on whose terms, the idea of the design process, on whose terms the design's taking place. And it came up in your talk, Rudolph, in terms of the idea of pseudo-participation. So I'm wondering, is that somewhere in this tension, there's a difference between, and I'm being a bit provocative in my rhetoric here, but there's a difference between a mob and an audience. Mobs being potentially destructive and audiences rarely being revolutionary. And what I'm thinking about there is the difference between subjectivity and subjugation. And both of your work is sort of, I think, finding really interesting balances between your curatorial interest in maintaining a certain kind of order and yet inviting a public into the creation process and, again, in your design work, because obviously you have goals both as an artist and as an engineer in some ways and as a designer, but also inviting in the ultimate users into the epistemological process of what they actually need. And I'm wondering, it's a methodological question because you're both practitioners. I'm wondering how you navigate that, how you know where the line is and when the line goes over. You mentioned that art installation that was taken down because the public got out of control. I'm just wondering how you navigate that space, that tension.
Well, as fast as you can. there's obviously, you know, sometimes things just happen in the galleries, and I think it is, as I said, you have to be responsive. So you have to basically have a staff that can address whatever happens in the galleries in an appropriate way. I'll give you one example that was that's not a mob, it was an individual, but it's sort of this idea that's very typical for San Francisco. The 1 Minute Sculptures by Erwin Wurm included also a refrigerator which had two holes into which you were supposed to put your arms and your head, kind of making an awkward physical thing with a human being on stage. And the instruction read, drink a beer, have a line, or smoke a joint inside the fridge. Believe it or not, one guy did it. So he actually smoked a joint inside the fridge just to challenge the museum. And then that was sort of an extraordinary event, obviously, but to simply remind this guy that absolutely smoking is not allowed in the museum, while we still appreciate his interest in challenging the conditions of participation and the constraints on that. On another note, we had a designed object in our educational spaces, which we tried hard to not define as educational spaces, but rather as an exhibition space. It was a New York design firm called Free Cell, and they developed a piece called Stack to Fold. And it was basically a piece of cardboard that had a number of different shapes, and you could fold it. You could take it from the wall and fold it into an object that would then also be used and function as furniture or objects in a space that was also a lecture space, a performative space, etc. Turns out this was not an easy job to do, and the instructions were quite difficult to follow. Once you had seen it, once you had done it, you understood perfectly how it worked, but just the first step. So at the same time, parallel to that, we had a once-a-week event called by, 20 years prior to relational aesthetics. Tom Arione, the act of drinking beer with friends is the highest form of art. It's a free beer event. You can imagine. Everybody loves that free beer. So we had a bar, and there was a performance taking place once a week, right next in proximity to the space. So we allowed alcohol, which is always a very, very difficult thing in a museum. We allowed alcohol in that space, and we'll imagine what happens with some alcohol. The stack to fold thing just exploded into a massive series of sculptures, heavily activated. The idea that you can control the excesses is an important distinction, as opposed to say we cannot allow anything. The idea that you leave things undefined, leave things open, even in the galleries, with certain conditions, is an important institutional paradigm shift, which happened in our museum, but it was difficult. The idea that you can collect something like that, that is not easily predictable in what actually happens, is another important paradigm shift. And I don't really have an answer to the mob question, because this can always happen, and it actually did happen, but not in the show that I curated, but rather as a closing event for our museum, which is going into expansion. And it closed on June 2nd and June 3rd with a two-day open and free access weekend with all kinds of events. We were mobbed by 13,000 people per day, and it was a 24-hour event. And, you know, it was all pretty much controlled until midnight, but not afterwards. So the idea that you can, you know, whatever happens, you can actually survive that. and you can, as an extraordinary moment, you can allow other levels of excess than you would typically allow in a gallery or in a museum. That notion that one can do that, one can also be a living organism, one can expand and stretch and not always have in place that exact firm line that divides control and out of control. I think that's an important shift in perception.
Yeah, I mean, I think is this on? Can you hear me? Ah, there we go. I think inviting and facilitating disruption is kind of I suppose that's a contradiction in terms, isn't it, in terms of supporting interactions that you haven't predicted. I think in the work that I've just shown, it probably is fair to say it played out with different degrees of success with different projects. I think the chairs were very successful because they... I think they started off as a fairly comparative, traditional comparative study of different models of tone of voice, and I think the audience participation really did turn that on its head. The responses we got back, rather than gravitating towards one or other of these established models, were far more heterogeneous, far messier. And so that really did set a challenge for any subsequent work about how can we start off thinking about tone of voice in a way that a lay audience do, rather than a way that a discipline that focuses on it does. I think Speech Hedge is probably less successful, if I'm being honest, because it's more propositional, and there's less space within it for subverting it and appropriating it, which is why I'm really excited about the next stage, because if we can conceive of actually building a sandpit for creating tones of voice and a social network around that, if we conceive that in the right way, then it really will be far more open-ended again. And I'm really, my highest aspiration is to be amazed and surprised by what actually happens when we create that.
Thanks to both of you for your great papers. I have a question for Graham. Graham, you said two things that were interesting in particular for the conference. The one was the comment on voice. And wouldn't it be interesting to think about the difference between voice as a metaphor, which we heard a lot about yesterday, and people who actually don't have voices or have disabled voices. And then I want to relate that to the point that you made drawing from your book, where you talk about the way that disability, thinking about really differential, I mean, in the case of the Eames, differential embodiments, leads to sort of mainstream design. What can disability then help us understand about participation that an assumption of a non-disabled normate body leaves us unaware of?
Okay, so two, they're both really interesting questions. I think the first one, in terms of participatory design, you know, maybe there's even a norm there that can be a very verbal process. It's about focus groups and co-creation workshops and things like that. And I think designing for, as I say, this joint challenge, designing with people whose spoken communication renders that more challenging, but also about a topic that's very difficult to put into words. It's very interesting. And one of the things I'm excited about is the potential role of techniques such as cultural probes, where visual and material objects and creativity are actually used to inform something that can less easily be directly put into words. So that's I don't know if that addresses your point at all. The second question, I think it comes back to the first question again. I think some particular disabled communities, and I'm more interested in specific groups than the concept of universal design in this space, because of their particular perspectives, cultures, needs, and exclusions can actually be very disruptive and give us perspectives that would not occur to us otherwise. I think having different opinions on technical and technological development is always a healthy thing, to have those to challenge very ingrained orthodox views.
Short of time, so what we'll do is take two questions and then have a slightly shorter break so that we can get the most out of our speakers here.
Hi, thanks. My name's Salen. I'm a PhD student at McGill, like Michael. My question is for Rudolf. In your talk, you alluded to the fact that historically participatory art has often been conceived of in this very democratic sense, sort of aligned with the idea that, you know, there's a passive spectator that can be activated by being introduced to a participatory framework. But then you also, in talking about that initiative at the Santa Cruz Museum, talked about how that is, a lot has shifted, and that now participation is sort of almost a sort of coercive norm. And I think we heard a lot about that yesterday, where, especially with regards to internet issues, participation sort of inducts the user into this circuit of quantification and marketing and surveillance, and also into the sort of temporal circuit of, you know, constant stimulation and distraction that's often been sort of talked about in terms of eliminating history and memory. So I think your exhibition about the history of participation is really useful, and I liked what you had to say about the responsiveness of the curator that's required there. But I was curious about whether, you know, given this sort of new norm of course of participation, whether making the historical work experiential rather than contemplative is always the right move, and I just sort of wondered if you could expand a little bit more on what responsiveness means for a museum under this sort of new condition.
Okay.
Take the second question right away.
My question is about reenactment in different social contexts. So I just wanted to know if there should be, if the artist can actually infiltrate in the actual performance, and or if the artist has to aim for any particular result when reenacting the performance in a totally different social context.
Okay, these sort of both questions relate. Let me give you two examples. One of the key historic moments, so one of the objectives of the show was also to bridge the gap between the histories and discourses of contemporary art versus the histories and discourses of media art. In order to do that, it was a stated objective to bring these two into one show and sort of see connections between the two. one of the works that has constantly evaded institutionalization, certainly museumification, is Kit Galloway and Sherry Rabinowitz's Hole in Space, which was a performative act, you could call it also social sculpture, in 1980, linking via satellite two live feeds from Los Angeles to New York and vice versa. It became a sort of cornerstone of the history of media art, but obviously it was an event. Now, how do you exhibit that in a gallery? And I took my clues from the artists themselves who had produced a documentary and a kind of excerpted version of 30 minutes, and they then reinstalled this. They produced an installation version for a museum whereby you would have two opposing or sort of facing juxtaposed projection screens of both sides. So New York looking at Los Angeles and vice versa. And I asked them to consider that we recreate that experience of a real-time event by displaying all six recorded hours synchronized. So you would have an actual experience of how this unfolded as opposed to a documentation of the highlights of that. It's an installation, though. It got sort of transformed into a museum piece through that. And that's been generally the case with most works, and I just said most performative works sort of ended up in the museums as documents or as vitrines of relics, and I find that at times aesthetically fascinating, of course. You know, it's great objects, and sometimes it's also an artistic choice to make it into something else. But the experience of a real-time interaction is a lot different from reading about this and looking at pictures. That's one thing. So to also go to outside of SFMOMA and going back to Marina Abramović, she installed, or MoMA installed, a work by her and Ulay called Improbabilia, which was basically the two performers standing naked, and the audience had to squeeze through the two naked bodies in order to enter the exhibition space. Now, that was the condition of the work. You squeeze through to experience the work and to enter the space. At MoMA, it was exhibited in a wall which left it open, whether you could go through or rather take another course to pursue in that exhibition. And that, to me, felt like a complete misinterpretation of what the core concept of the work is, which is you either participate or you don't experience the work, and you then don't have an aesthetic experience of a show. So giving an option, obviously, you know, I work in the U.S., so it's highly regulated in terms of museums. There are ADA stuff you have to deal with, you know, wheelchair access and so on. So the idea that you could, you know, also egress and whatnot, it's really complicated. But to have a work where you can, where you then don't squeeze but rather comfortably walk through, is also not a good option to reenact this. So my point is that I think there is no general answer to the question. There are certain cases where you might very well decide that this is simply not doable. It was a one-time event. However, I think we're also in the business of exploring ways of exhibiting and making accessible histories. So I think it's a fair proposal to say we should at least try how to exhibit something as an experiential moment, as opposed to not go that way at all. Afterwards, you know, somebody can come and say, I don't think that was a good solution. I think this should actually go back to the previous form of display, and that's perfectly fine with me. Does that answer the question? I mean, I have a lot to say about reenactments, but we're not going there right now, I guess.
So thank you to Graham Pullen and Rudolf Freeling, and we'll take a short 15-minute break and start again at 10:45.